It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.rir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Well, I don't think anybody signs up to be in the kind of pain and to have the medical conditions that those 14 million people have to be on disability, for one. At the same time... people who get disability benefits do not get a lot of money out of this. The average payment for the SSDI program is $1,100 a month. SSI is just over $700 a month. So someone who gets $1,100 a month is below the federal poverty level. $13,000 a year is less than the federal poverty line. So the idea that someone is going to sign up to be poor, it's a little bit hard to take.
Private attorney Joanna Suez corrects the distorted views advanced by a series recently aired on National Public Radio, Unfit for Work, The Startling Rise of Disability in America, which painted a misleading and inaccurate picture of the Social Security disability programs that serve as a vital lifeline for millions of Americans with severe disabilities. And during this week's News You Can Use, we'll tell you about the strict limits put on predatory lenders by Chesterfield County. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show was supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 202, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio and online at www.rir.org and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Earlier this month, Chesterfield County adopted a strict policy limiting where lenders offering high-cost instant loans can operate. These lenders must maintain a minimum separation of 1 mile between them and are banned from locating next to residential property or in 5 areas designated for revitalization. The policy also prohibits more than one type of these predatory lenders from operating under the same roof. The lenders are defined as providing short-term, high-interest personal lending services that do not include banks, credit unions, savings and loan associations, or precious metal dealers. The new policy will pave the way for 5 pending applications to be heard next month by the Planning Commission. Currently, there are no car title lenders or payday lenders in Chesterfield County, but there are 5 applications pending, 3 from TitleMax, 1 from Community Loans of America, and 1 from LoanMax. Every time one of these predatory lenders wants to open a new business, the new policy requires a public notice and a hearing. In other news, recently the Bipartisan Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA, was reenacted. The reauthorization bill enhances response to sexual assault, domestic violence, and stalking on college campuses, improves protections for Native American and immigrant victims, and ensures access to safety and services for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, or LGBT, victims. Since VAWA first passed in 1994, it has created an infrastructure in many Virginia communities to help victims escape their abusers. Before VAWA's reauthorization and funding, that infrastructure was at risk, even though the need for domestic and sexual violence assistance has not abated. The reenacted law gives Native American tribal courts the authority they need to hold offenders in their communities accountable. It also prohibits discrimination against LGBT survivors of violence and prevents discrimination against unjust evictions of survivors of domestic violence in all federally subsidized housing programs. The law now explicitly protects victims of sexual assault and creates emergency housing transfer options. Immigrant survivors of domestic violence will have improved provisions about self-petitioning and U visas, and colleges now are required to implement a recording process for incidences of dating violence, report the findings, create plans to prevent this dating violence, and educate victims on their rights and resources. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here in the near west end of Henrico County at the law office of Marks & Harrison. We are speaking with disability attorney Joanna Suez, and we are going to be talking about the NPR series that aired the last week of March called Unfit for Work, and trying really to set the record straight on the Social Security and SSI disability programs. Welcome back to the show, Joanna.
Thanks, Marty.
To give our listeners a bit of background, would you briefly explain what the Social Security and SSI disability programs are?
Sure. There's really two main programs. There is the Supplemental Security Income Program that is for low-income people who are disabled. And there is the Social Security Disability Insurance Program, and that's for people who have worked a certain number of years, paid into the system, and have now found themselves disabled.
And what is the process for people to get either Social Security or SSI disability benefits?
Okay. Well, the process is actually fairly complicated. Most people have to apply, and that in itself a time-consuming process. It takes several hours for them to do that, either in person or online. At that point, Social Security Administration obtains their records and information about them and about their work history, and then issues a decision. Most people get denied at this stage. Approximately two-thirds of the people who apply are denied at this first stage, and many people just choose not to continue in the process.
What about the ones who appeal? What happens to them?
So they appeal, and then that next stage is called reconsideration stage. So Social Security does what it sounds like they're going to do. They reconsider the application and get a little bit more information from the claimant, if there is any, and make a decision. Now, at this stage, about 10 to 12% of people are approved. The vast majority are denied at reconsideration.
And assuming someone goes beyond the reconsideration, having been denied twice, what's the next step in the process?
Well, right. A lot of people, again, choose not to go through a second appeal. But if you do choose to appeal again, technically what you're doing is requesting a hearing before an administrative law judge. That process from request to hearing, generally, at least in the Richmond area, can take upwards of a year from the request to the hearing. At that point, Social Security places the person's file in line for a hearing. It gets developed even further. The Office of Disability Adjudication and Review will call the claimant and say your hearing is going to be on whichever date they choose, and then they go before an administrative law judge who questions them about their alleged disability, the treatment they've received, the limitations they have, their work history, any kind of other sort of issues that may come up. And then the administrative law judge makes a decision.
Now, substantively, what does someone have to prove in order to get these disability benefits?
Well, Social Security requires that a person have a medically determinable condition that is severe, that will last or has lasted for a year or will result in the person's death, and it keeps them from being able to do any substantial gainful employment.
Okay, so now that we have an overview of the system, let's talk about the NPR series. And it lasted a whole week, and it started with talking about Hale County, Alabama, rural county in Alabama, where, according to the NPR series, one in four adults were receiving disability benefits. Do you find this to be surprising, unusual, troubling, or is this simply a reflection of that particular county?
Well, I don't know what's going on in Hale, Alabama, but I find that one in four adults getting disability is a bit high. But of the disabled Americans, there are about 38 million disabled Americans, and only 14 million of those are receiving benefits. So when you think of the number of Americans, disabled or not, it is a much different ratio than one in four be getting benefits.
Well, one of the things that the NPR series was talking about, people who were claiming disability due to things like high blood pressure or diabetes or back problems or mental problems, things you can't visibly see. Does that make their disability any less real to Social Security or to an advocate?
No. Well, first of all, I had said that it has to be a medically determinable impairment. So it's not that a person is just going in and a judge is looking at them and saying, well, okay, you're disabled. There has to be medical evidence to support this person's disability. Whether you can see someone's disability or not is really immaterial. People can get disability for traumatic brain injury, for post-traumatic stress disorder, for cancer, for things that you can't necessarily see. It does have to be medically determinable.
And certain things must be difficult to medically determine. For example, a lot of people will be disabled because of pain. That's certainly true for back injuries, although it can be true for shoulder, knee, you know, any type of arthritis. How do you determine that medically?
Not being a doctor, I'll tell you how I look at it as a lawyer. When I have a client who claims pain, I immediately look to see whether there have been any kind of x-rays done, MRIs that might show some sort of condition that would result in pain, if they have any kind of objective evidence of the pain. And furthermore, we also get opinions from the person's doctor to have the doctor state whether or not they believe that the person is suffering from the symptoms that they claim. And if so, how severe?
And that's a good segue to my next question, because the NPR series talked about doctors that tend to be, at least in Hale County, Alabama, very favorable to claimants, that everybody sends their claimants to this particular doctor and he writes great reports for them. Is this an isolated instance, or are there, you know, quote, claimant docs that are customarily used by claimant attorneys to generate these favorable reports?
Well, again, I can't speak specifically to the doctor in Alabama, but when I was listening to that series, my first thought was that there are people who cannot afford to get treatment, and so they tend to funnel to the same places, the same clinics that give treatment for free. So you do see a lot of the same doctors over and over again. We don't send people to specific doctors. We don't have doctors that we think are favorable to our claimants, but people do see the same doctors because they end up in the same clinics where they don't have to pay for the treatment they're receiving.
Another point of the NPR series was that people might possibly be able to do certain types of, you know, low stress or low physical ability jobs, and they just don't want to do them. But I gather that's not really the test of disability, that if, as you pointed out, if they're older, less educated, have a work history that wouldn't allow them to do that, then they're not expected to do those jobs. Is that pretty much the standard that's used?
Right. If you're 60 years old and you've spent your life working production at one of the plants around town, and now you find yourself, maybe you're able to sit for most of the day, but you certainly can't do the exertion that's required of somebody to work on a production line, then Social Security does not require you get a job where you're sitting down all day necessarily. There's some other factors at play.
And another comment that was made on the NPR series Unfit for Work was that, well, as the economy has gotten bad, more and more people are just signing up for disability. What's your take on that?
Well, my take on that is that while the economy was good, that a lot of employers are good people and they were trying to accommodate their workers who probably should have been on disability. And once the economy went bad, those people are some of the first to get laid off. So the people who are now laid off and disabled and should have probably been on disability before are now applying. Of course, a lot of people are applying who don't understand the process, and they call my office and they say, I've got a broken leg, I want to go on disability. We screen those out. Social Security screens those out. Those people don't get disability. But there are a lot of people whose employers were able to accommodate their situation, and it became too expensive for the employer to do that. So Social Security is a safety net for them.
And what has been the experience with the increasing number of disability applications since the economy went bad?
Sure. There have been a rise in applications since the economy went bad. But at the same time, there has also been a decline in the number of approvals from Social Security.
And there was one line in the NPR series that really sort of irked me a little bit, and it said something to the following. Going on disability means you will not work, you will not get a raise, you will not get whatever meaning people get from work. Going on disability means, assuming you rely only on those disability payments, you will be poor for the rest of your life. That's the deal, and it's a deal 14 million Americans have signed up for, was the exact phrase. What's your take on 14 million people signing up to be on disability?
Well, I don't think anybody signs up to be in the kind of pain and to have the medical conditions that those 14 million people have to be on disability, for one. At the same time, people who get disability benefits do not get a lot of money out of this. The average payment for the SSDI program is $1,100 a month. SSI is just over $700 a month. So someone who gets $1,100 a month is below the federal poverty level. $13,000 a year is less than the federal poverty line. So the idea that someone is going to sign up to be poor is a little bit hard to take.
Now let's talk about children's cases, because a number of people might be surprised to learn that children are eligible in certain cases for SSI disability, not Social Security disability because they've not worked, but for SSI disability. Could you explain briefly how a child can be found disabled for SSI disability benefits?
Okay. Well, children are sort of the same as adults in that we have to show that their disability results in them being not able to do a lot of the things that children do. And what do children do mostly? They go to school. So one thing that one piece of the puzzle that we use is to rely on school records to see whether the child misses a lot of time, has difficulty interacting in their classroom. But that's only one small piece of the puzzle. The child has to have, again, a medically determinable impairment that would result in a condition that keeps them from being able to attend school or to act in school like most children are able to act.
Now, one part of the NPR series seemed to suggest, actually fairly strongly, that children who are seeking SSI disability or who are already on SSI disability are coached to behave badly in school or to not do well in school. What's your response to that?
Well, again, the piece about their attendance at school is only a small part of it. There has to be proof that they have a medically determinable impairment of some type, whether it's physical or mental. And the other comment I'll make is that the amount of money that children, or really anyone, can get on SSI is very, very small, and it's a means-based test. So it's a little bit hard to believe that people would want to rely on $700 a month in income if they had some other means of making money and having a job.
And I gather that the cost of taking care of a truly disabled child could be way more than $700 a month that the child would be eligible for on SSI.
Right. Of course, the child would be eligible for Medicaid being on SSI, but still, the medical costs for treating a child are astronomical. It's not cost effective necessarily to go on SSI.
The next part of the NPR series talked about how people are no longer eligible for cash benefits for welfare. What used to be the aid to families with dependent children program, it's now the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, TANF, and that the shrinking TANF rolls are one of the things that's been pushing people onto disability benefits. Do you find any truth to this, or is this a misconception?
I believe that the increase in the disability rolls and the decrease in the TANF rolls are probably coincidental. The increase in the disability rolls is more due to the increase in the age of the workforce and the fact that women are now a part of the workforce. And as far as children go, part of the increase is because of the dramatic increase in the number of children who live in poverty. And so I would guess that that's more the reason than just necessarily people deciding to move from TANF to SSI. Again, there has to be a medically determinable impairment. You can't just go on SSI because you're poor.
And the final piece of the NPR series was talking about what the producer or the writer described as the disability industrial complex. And here they were going after everybody's favorite target, lawyers, that somehow lawyers were also responsible for what was described as a dramatic rise in the number of people on disability. Would you care to defend our profession?
I'll gladly defend our profession. She was right in that there is not an attorney on the other side of the case. There is no government attorney who is defending the government. But the difficulty with her argument is that she picked one firm that has a nationwide presence and makes a lot of money because of their nationwide presence. Attorneys' fees are capped at 25% of back benefits or $6,000, whichever is smaller. So a lot of attorneys who are handling disability claims, well, they're not really getting rich. That's not a whole lot of money per claim. Not to mention the fact that the Social Security Administration is doing a pretty good job of policing the claims that come in. The judges are conscientious and working hard to make a fair and correct decision. Just because there is an advocate for the claimant who's helping the claimant navigate the process, that doesn't mean that the advocates are doing shady things to get the claimant's benefits won.
The other thing that was omitted from the NPR story is the fact that if the disability attorney does not win the case, the disability attorney gets
zero.
And so how does that affect your practice in terms of the cases that you're going to take to an administrative law judge hearing?
Well, we screen them pretty closely. We make sure that we believe that it's something that we could possibly win. I don't want to spend a lot of time working on a case that I know is not going to go anywhere. So we have a screening process that's pretty stringent. And some other statistics to throw in are that with an advocate, claimants are successful around 70 to 75% of the time. So most advocates are still losing about a quarter of the cases that they bring. Of course, that's a much higher number than people who go in without some kind of advocate who knows what they're doing.
And what are those figures for people who go into a Social Security law judge hearing without an advocate?
People who go in without an advocate typically win about 35 to 40% of the time.
So the attorney is making a big difference, but again, they have to make that difference in order to get paid.
Right, that's right.
Well, and I guess lastly, what do you see as the future of the disability program? Because again, the picture that was portrayed by the NPR series was, we're going broke.
If you listen to the former commissioner of Social Security, Astru, he says, rightly, that the current state of the Social Security program was expected. They expected to have to make some adjustments between the different pools of money, and that they would expect to have to do that in 2016, and that's exactly what's probably going to have to happen. That's happened several times in the past, that they've had to adjust based on their expectations.
Well, thank you very much. We have been speaking with Joanna Suez at the law firm of Marks & Harrison in the near west end of Henrico County, and we've been talking about the NPR series that aired the last week of March, Unfit for Work, The Startling Rise of Disability in America, and trying to set the record straight and explain just exactly how stringent the program is and how misleading the series was. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Marty.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral four, all.net. Then click the contributor link. Then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. The types of adoption and assisted reproductive techniques and the laws governing each type can be very confusing for all involved. Join us next week when private attorney Colleen Quinn talks about adoption and surrogacy and the laws governing how new families are built in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on September 14, 2011. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.